We have a delightful opportunity this morning. Back not quite a year ago, but many months ago, last academic year, when we were thinking about the speaker and topic that the pastoral ministry department would like to host for this academic year. And by the way, back in those days, I was under the able leadership of Dr. Schultz as department chairman at that time. At that time, Professor Pless had an excellent idea. And so to tell you about that excellent idea, who happens to be a person and a very informative speaker, we invite Professor Pless to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Fekincher. Again, welcome to this convocation. We're very pleased to have with us today Dr. Ronald Rutgers. My first time actually meeting him in person, we think. We may have met actually at a funeral at Valpo a couple of years ago, but I've certainly benefited from his work, particularly his latest book, The Reformation of Suffering, Pastoral Theology and Lay Piety in Late Medieval and Early Modern Germany. I've used this as a text for STM elective in Advanced Pastoral Theology. Used it as a text last summer out in Oregon for a class on theology of suffering. A phenomenal book. I only wish that it would have been out about a year earlier, because I would have. Yeah, you too probably. This came just as I was sending off the manuscript for my own book on Luther's pastoral theology. So I included you in the bibliography, but didn't actually get to really benefit in preparing my own manuscript from your excellent work, but it's a fine book, highly recommend it. Earlier book by Dr. Rutgers, Reformation of the Keys, a study of the office of the keys in Reformation theology, and then most recently in the Oxford Handbook of Martin Luther's Theology, Dr. Rutgers has the chapter on Luther's pastoral theology. And so if you have a lot of money, because Oxford is not a cheap CPH kind of publisher, they'll be happy to take your money there. But it's a great text and highly recommend them. Dr. Rutgers is a native of Iowa. He was on the faculty at Yale Divinity School for 7 years before deciding to return to the Midwest. When he received an appointment to be a member of the faculty at Valparaiso University, holding the Eric Markle Chair of German Reformation Studies and also a member of the Department of Theology. And so we're very pleased to welcome Dr. Ronald Rutgers to our campus. It's his first visit here. He is going to be speaking today on the topic, He Who Is Not a Crustean Is Not a Christian, Martin Luther's Pastoral Theology of Suffering. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ronald Rutgers.
Thank you for that kind introduction. Yes, the goal of writing a book is to become a footnote or a bibliography item in someone else's book. Mission accomplished. I want to thank Professor Pless for this invitation to give this talk. It's really an honor and a privilege for me to be with you here today, especially as he mentioned, it's my first time here. What a lovely campus. I don't think I'd get any work done if I were on a campus like this. I'd be out strolling in the woods. Maybe some of you students have used that excuse as well now and again. I'm most gratified to learn that Professor Pless has actually used my book in a course. When you write a book, you sort of wonder whether anyone ever reads it. And it's very gratifying to know that it has been used here. And I'm especially gratified because one of the reasons I wrote The Reformation of Suffering was to try to engage those who were interested in pastoral theology. I try to make a contribution to scholarship in the book, and I'm also interested in trying to provide resources for those who are actually engaged in the care of souls. And it's gratifying to me that that latter goal has met with at least some success here at Concordia. Here's the argument of my book, which will save you about $80. Martin Luther wanted to reform the way his contemporaries understood and sought to cope with suffering. And this reformation of suffering was an essential, though understudied, part of his overall reformation agenda. Suffering, the reformation of suffering, was central to the reformation itself. In my talk today, I would like to examine with you a crucial chapter in Luther's reformation of suffering, the indulgence controversy, and the years following from it. I want to explore how Luther's critique of the late medieval penitential system and the soteriology upon which it was based played a central role in his reformation of suffering, a reformation that was motivated by deeply pastoral concerns and that had profound implications for pastoral theology. Here's the argument of this talk. I hope to show how this reformation of suffering entailed both a summons to radical cross-bearing and the provision of a radical form of consolation. My presentation will be primarily historical in nature, but I am more than happy to discuss implications for what I have to say for modern pastoral theology and pastoral care in the Q&A that will follow. Before we turn to Luther, a brief word about late medieval penitential theology and its views of suffering is in order. In the later Middle Ages, there was a widespread agreement among theologians about a distinction that was absolutely central to the Church's understanding of penance and suffering. The distinction is this: the guilt or debt of sin versus the penalty or punishment for sin. The debt of sin, the culpa, referred to the burden of guilt human beings incurred initially as a result of the fall, and then subsequently as the result of each post-baptismal sin. The penalty for sin, pena, denoted divine punishment for both original sin and for post-baptismal sin. The majority view on the eve of the Reformation was that Christ's death had atoned for original guilt and eternal damnation, part of that penalty, the benefits of which were communicated via baptism. But the tendency towards sinning, the fomes peccati, the tinderboxes of sin, remained for humanity to contend with until the resurrection of the dead. When late medieval Christians gave in to their dark side and sinned, which the Church fully expected they would do, they were instructed to turn, of course, to the sacrament of penance to relieve the new burden of debt and punishment that they incurred. Not to seek divine grace for sin was to risk an eternity in hell if the sin were mortal, or more typically, to face an extended time of in purgatory, where one would suffer the remaining penalty for one's venial sins, along with the yet unfulfilled works of satisfaction that one had been assigned, and thus be purified before one entered heaven. Only priestly absolution, communicated through the sacrament of penance, could forgive the debt of sin, but it was up to the penitent to deal with the penalty for sin in cooperation with the Latin Church's many forms of assistance, which of course included indulgences. Indulgences were about the penalty for sin, not the guilt, at least in theory. By virtue of their possession of the power of the keys, priests could transform the penalty that one deserved to suffer in purgatory, where the pains were unspeakable, if temporary, into a more bearable form of penance that one could endure in the here and now. This penance, or work of satisfaction, typically took one of three forms: fasting, prayer, or works of mercy. These three were held to fulfill the definition of a work of satisfaction, which involved making amends for past sins, that is, compensating God for wrongs committed against God, providing healing for the effects of sin, and protecting against future sins. Works of satisfaction were supposed to accomplish all three. Late medieval penitential theology taught that whereas prayer restored proper order in the penitent's relationship with God, and works of mercy did the same with regard to neighbor, fasting brought order to the penitent's relationship with himself, primarily by battling concupiscence of the flesh. Here's the crucial point. suffering was viewed in late medieval penitential theology as a species of fasting. That's where you find it located in late medieval confession manuals. Suffering is a species of fasting. It was a work of satisfaction that atoned for the penalty of sin, healed the effects of sin, and helped to prevent further sin. Penitents were regularly instructed to ask their confessors to apply to them not only the merit of Christ and their own good works, but also any sickness, any adversity, any suffering they had willingly endured. One popular late medieval handbook for confession instructed penitents to make the following request of their confessors. This is what a penitent is supposed to say to his or her confessor. I ask you, lastly, that you would now place on me a small and brief sacramental penance that I can perform already in this hour or on this day, because if you didn't perform the penance, the absolution was not efficacious. I also ask that you would apply to me, counting it as a penance, the merit of our Lord Jesus Christ's suffering, along with all my good works and those that others have done for me, plus all the grace and indulgence I have obtained, and here's the crucial line, and also all the sickness and adversity I have suffered, and finally, all the concern and work by which I meet my basic needs. Apply to me all of these things as a satisfaction for my sin. You're supposed to ask your confessor to apply your suffering to your spiritual bank account, so to speak. Thus, according to late medieval penitential thought, suffering, if humbly accepted and patiently endured, could be treated as a form of penance that would redound to one's eternal benefit. In this system, suffering could actually be seen as an expression of divine grace because it provided one with an opportunity to shorten one's stay in purgatory and also to be conformed more closely to the image of Christ. In short, suffering was salvific. And I think this is an extraordinarily powerful idea in late medieval pastoral theology. Whatever you make of it theologically, you can understand how plausible this would become for people, a way of making sense of suffering that actually redounds to your eternal benefit. Luther didn't like that idea, as you probably already know. Luther engaged this view of suffering and the penitential theology behind it in the famous indulgence controversy, which catapulted him onto the public stage of early modern Christendom in ways he never could have expected. In the midst of this conflict, Luther continued to work out the implications of his increasingly radical soteriology, a process that had begun, in my opinion, even before his first psalm lectures of 1513 to 1515. Begun, not finished. Most important among these implications was a decisive break with late medieval penitential theology, along with its consequences for how Christians were to view suffering. The reformation of soteriology and the reformation of suffering went hand in hand for Luther. Ironically, though, the road to this break began with a very traditional concern: to warn Christians about the dangers of spiritual laxity and to exhort them to take up the cross and follow Christ through tribulations of every kind. Many late medieval reformers and mystics shared this concern, and Luther had voiced it since the beginning of his professorial career. But the theological conclusions he reached as he articulated this concern were anything but conventional. In the 95 Theses, Luther assumes this traditional distinction between debt and penalty. That's why I took the time to explain it briefly. But he also makes an important differentiation within the whole category of penalty for sin that proved to be quite radical. He distinguishes between divinely imposed punishment or penalty and its human counterpart, by which he means papal counterpart. He concedes that the Pope has authority to forgive penalties, but only those penalties which the Pope himself imposes in the form of works of satisfaction. According to Luther, the Pope has no power to affect the divine penalty for sin that remains until human beings enter heaven. And what is that divine penalty? The lifelong repentance that he calls for right at the beginning of the 95 Theses. Neither can the Pope affect the condition of souls in purgatory. The Pope's ability to bind and loose sins ends when a person dies, a severe curtailment of papal authority. Departed souls are in God's hands. Thus, for Luther, indulgences are simply a man-made form of release from man-made penalties that in no way provide forgiveness for divinely imposed penalties. So this distinction between divinely imposed penalties for sin and man-made penalties for sin is crucial. Luther argues that the problem with indulgences is that they produce in those who obtain them false confidence and spiritual laxity. People trust in indulgences rather than in divine mercy and ignore Christ's call to true repentance, believing that possession of an indulgence relieves them of the need to take up the cross. Echoing late medieval mystics and reformers such as Johannes Tauler and Jean Gerson, Luther insists that suffering under the cross is the Christian's lot and privilege. As he puts it in the final two theses, quote, "Christians should be exhorted to be diligent in following Christ their head through penalties, death, and hell, and thus be confident of entering heaven through many tribulations rather than through the false security of peace." According to Luther, divinely ordained suffering is to be embraced and patiently endured, not avoided or rejected in favor of sacramental penances or indulgences. He maintains that there is no release from the divine penalty for sin in this life and insists that it is both dangerous and unchristian to seek one. Luther sounded much the same message in a sermon on indulgence of grace, which was published in March of 1518. This vernacular work, of course, had a far wider readership, especially lay readership, than the 95 Theses. In the Sermon on Indulgence and Grace, Luther again makes a distinction between the human and divine penalty for sin, insisting that indulgences have no impact on the latter, as only God can remit it. Luther also argues that God requires no penalty or satisfaction for sin beyond sinners' heartfelt and true repentance and conversion, along with their willingness to take up the cross. Nothing more is required to receive the free gift of divine forgiveness. And those who think differently, that is, those who think they can atone for sin through works of satisfaction, are, according to Luther, engaged in ein großer Irrtum, a great error. Luther teaches in his sermon that Christians should seek to endure tribulations sent by God, not because they render satisfaction for sin, but because they contribute to Christians' spiritual improvement, which he argues is God's whole purpose in sending them. This was a radical break with late medieval penitential theology and its teaching about suffering. And this break had profound implications for how Luther understood the role of tribulation and adversity in the Christian life. Here, Luther makes it abundantly clear that he will not allow suffering to be placed on some kind of soteriological scales in order to tip them in the Christian's favor. In fact, Luther never allowed this. Not even in his earliest psalm lectures, where suffering appears to have salvific value as a cause of self-accusation, this whole humility theology. From the beginning of his career as a professor of theology, Luther was silent on the issue of suffering as a work of satisfaction. That is incredibly important. I have not been able to find anywhere in the early Luther where he even begins to move in the direction of suffering being a work of satisfaction. That in and of itself is a huge break, the first of many. This silence is no doubt owing to the fact that Luther was simply not interested in human merit and the role it might play in salvation. He was not interested in soteriological scales because in his mind, sinful humanity had absolutely nothing to place on them, except its sin. In the Sermon on Indulgence and Grace, Luther criticizes certain modern preachers who make a distinction between two kinds of penalties for sin, curative and satisfactory. He rejects the latter category, satisfactory, and places all divine penalty in the former one. He insists that, quote, "All penalty, indeed, everything that God lays upon Christians is besserlich, edifying for them, and able to be borne by them." Luther cites 1 Corinthians 10:13 in order to encourage his readers that God will not test them beyond what they can bear, arguing that they therefore have no need of indulgences to reduce the punishment of sin. As in the 95 Theses, Luther maintains that the great failing of indulgences is that they cater to the human desire to avoid suffering and therefore robs human beings of its benefits. Indulgences have only been allowed on account of, quote, immature and lazy Christians. This critique of spiritual laxity was an important recurring theme in Luther's teaching, preaching, and writing in the early 15-teens through the end of the indulgence controversy. He felt that a good deal of the popular piety of his day was a merely external piety that shunned divinely ordained suffering and its benefits. This critique was directly informed by Luther's emerging theology of the cross, something that is abundantly clear in his explanations of the 95 Theses, which is where he actually used the term theology of the cross for the first time. The first time he did it publicly was in the Heidelberg Disputation, but in writing it was in the explanations. In this work, The Explanations of the 95 Theses, published in August of 1518, Luther accused his opponents of being theologians of glory who relied on reason and human moral effort to establish and to achieve the good. These faux theologians failed to understand how deeply flawed human intellectual and moral capacities had become after the fall, and how strongly inclined the human will was towards self-deification. They also failed to understand how, since the fall, God had acted to humble human pride by choosing to reveal himself through the folly of the cross. Theologians of the cross, on the other hand, understood the need for God to reveal himself under the contrary, and for human beings to be humbled, even annihilated, if they were to become, as Luther put it in the Heidelberg Disputation, Christ's action and instrument. Theologians of the cross therefore embraced all manner of divinely imposed suffering as God's chosen means of reducing human beings to nothing so that they could receive everything, especially justification from God as a free gift. Now, interestingly, Luther did not reject traditional penitential piety in the explanations, including the belief in purgatory, which I'll come back to in just a few minutes. But he did sharply criticize abuses of traditional devotion, especially the way it was used to avoid, again, divinely imposed suffering. This is what he had to say about popular piety from a perspective of a theologian of the cross. A theologian of the cross teaches that divine punishments, crosses, and death are the most precious treasury of all and the most sacred relics which the Lord of this theology himself has consecrated and blessed, not alone by the embrace of his most holy flesh, but also by the embrace of his exceedingly holy and divine will. And he has left these relics here to be kissed, sought after, and embraced. Indeed, fortunate and blessed is he who is considered by God to be so worthy that these treasures of the relics of Christ should be given to him. Rather, who understands that they are given to him? For to whom are they not offered? As St. James says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you meet various trials. There's Luther citing James positively. At least once. Luther went on to lament the fact that so many people who went on pilgrimage to view sacred relics did not recognize, quote, the true relic. Namely, this is still Luther, the sufferings and crosses which have sanctified the bones and relics of the martyrs and made them worthy of such great veneration. Such true relics were available to Christians every day, if only they had the faith to see and accept them, something the theology of glory rendered impossible. Now, of course, Luther would reject indulgences, along with belief in relics and the cult of the saints, insisting that each was a superstitious means of escape from divinely imposed purgation. They prevented people from taking up the cross. That's what I've been driving at. They prevented people from taking up the cross. Luther would also argue that each of these traditional forms of piety was a tragic means of escape from the divinely ordained means of consolation that he sought to articulate in the indulgence controversy. Radical cross-bearing and radical consolation went hand in hand in Luther's reformation of suffering, which, as I've already asserted, went hand in hand with his reformation of soteriology. This radical consolation took the form of relief from a guilty conscience on the basis of grace alone. In addition to separating divinely imposed penalty for sin from its human counterpart and urging his contemporaries to embrace the suffering that came from heaven for their spiritual improvement, Luther also sought to show during the indulgence controversy how the Latin Church's, from his point of view, obsession with man-made penalties and their remission had obscured from view the central importance of forgiveness of guilt. Because by this point, Luther placed so little stock in ecclesiastical punishments, and because he saw no way to escape divinely imposed penalties, Luther sought to focus his contemporaries' attention on the remission of guilt. But there remained an important connection for him between divinely imposed penalties and the divine remission of guilt. The only way to endure the penalties was to have certainty that God had remitted the guilt. The only way to take up the cross, this radical cross-bearing that Luther is after, is to embrace or to be embraced by this radical consolation. Luther argues in a little-known treatise for the investigating of truth and the consoling of fearful consciences in the summer of 1518, quote, "The remission of guilt calms the heart and takes away the greatest of all punishments, namely, the consciousness of sin." Later in the same treatise, Luther asserts, and those of you who know Latin, get ready because it's coming at you. I want you to translate it. "Where guilt and conscience have been forgiven, nulla pena est in pena." Nulla pena est in pena. Right. There's no penalty in penalty. There's no punishment in punishment. There's no pain in punishment. I mean, there's all these ways of translating it. The point is, punishment is no longer punishment. Therefore, it's no longer painful. But there is joy in tribulations, is the way the quotation ends. There's no pain in punishment. There's no punishment in punishment. But there is joy in tribulations. In comments like these on the forgiveness of guilt, there is a striking new emphasis on certainty of absolution. As Luther writes in the same treatise, quote, "Therefore it is certain that sins are loosed if you believe they have been loosed, because the promise of Christ the Savior is certain," Matthew 16:19. Luther thus bases peace for the troubled conscience, including his own, of course, firmly and exclusively on faith in the promises of the Word. This newfound confidence had direct implications for Luther's theology of suffering. Armed with the certainty of forgiveness and the peace it entailed, the believer could face divine penalties joyfully, knowing that they actually were not penalties. They were not a form of divine punishment for sin, because Christ had taken all punishment for sin on himself. Nor were they a means of rendering satisfaction to the divine judge. Rather, they were and could only be an opportunity to have one's faith and love proved by one's heavenly Father. One's salvation was not at stake. One's ongoing redemption from sin's effects as a fruit of salvation was. This rejection of suffering as penance signaled a crucial break with late medieval penitential theology and with much of the Latin Christian tradition. It also created an enormous problem for Luther. A pastoral problem, because if you take away this central way of trying to make suffering that you can find all over the pastoral literature of the later Middle Ages, what do you put in its place? It's a huge problem. In another talk that I gave at Notre Dame, I've actually found Luther's earliest and most strident lay supporter, Lazarus Spengler, a city councilman from Nuremberg, wrote the earliest pro-Luther pamphlet, still bought into this whole thing of suffering being a penance for sin, even after his name had been appended to the bull threatening Luther with excommunication. That's how deeply ingrained this view of things was. And he had no idea that he wasn't supposed to be saying that, Lazarus Spengler. So this is a radical break. This break also had important implications for Luther's attitude towards purgatory. I told you we'd come back to purgatory. We won't stay long. While Luther could assert in the explanations of the 95 Theses, listen to this, I am positive there is a purgatory. That's Luther, summer 1518. I am positive there is a purgatory. His understanding of what took place in purgatory was quite different from much of the tradition that preceded him. As we have seen, Luther rejected the need for human beings to make satisfaction for sin, whether in this life or the next. Therefore, purgatory could not be a punitorium, where one suffered the remaining punishment for sin. Rather, it could only be a purgatorium, where one was purged of self-love and caused to love the divine will. This was the quote-unquote perfect spiritual health that Luther believed was required of those who could enter heaven. Luther retained this modified view of purgatory for some time, and as you may know, did not finally publicly reject it until 1530. Luther also believed in the reality and necessity of a premortem purgatory at this point. In the explanations, Luther writes movingly of his experience of utter God-forsakenness, which he interprets as a foretaste of the pains of purgatory and hell. He says of these most extreme of Anfechtungen, quote, in this instance, the person is stretched out with Christ so that all his bones may be counted, and every corner of the soul is filled with the greatest bitterness, dread, trembling, and sorrow in such a manner that all of these seem to last forever. Luther goes on in this treatise to praise the mystic Johannes Tauler as one who understands this experience, thus demonstrating his sympathy for at least some mystics in the crucial years of his soteriological development. In keeping with his emphasis on the necessity of enduring affliction sent by God, Luther argues that Christians should not flee such suffering. Rather, they should embrace it and trust God, thereby finding peace and repose for their consciences. As with post-mortem suffering, the goal of such experiences is to test faith and to prove love, not to render satisfaction for sin. Luther was not the first theologian to interpret suffering as a this-worldly purgatory. Read The Imitation of Christ, and it's there. But his rejection of notions of merit and satisfaction in connection with such experiences was unique and radical. Suffering Christians could no longer view their tribulation as a penance which, if patiently borne, could reduce their time in purgatory. Tribulation had now lost its place in the traditional economy of salvation. Suffering was no longer salvific. But I think it was redemptive. The indulgence controversy thus marked a crucial chapter in the development of Luther's theology of suffering. Central to this development was a thoroughgoing theological critique of the penalty for sin as traditionally understood. As we have seen, Luther posited a distinction between the divine and human penalties for sin and stressed the importance of the former while he disparaged the latter. He also argued for a vital connection between the assurance of forgiveness of guilt and the Christian's ability to embrace and endure divinely imposed suffering, a connection he underscored by insisting that believers could have certainty of forgiveness through faith in the promises of the Word and also confidence that the tribulations they experienced were not punishments. They were purgative. These assertions, in turn, were directly influenced by Luther's theology of salvation, which by the end of the indulgence controversy left no room for human agency and thus no possibility or need of rendering satisfaction for sin. Luther had rejected the optimistic soteriology of the Via Moderna, the ho facere quod in se est, do what is within you and God will reward it, and had taken to a rather radical conclusion the emphasis on divine mercy and human passivity that is so apparent in the works of late medieval theologians such as Gerson, Paltz, and Johann von Staupitz. You can also find this extreme emphasis on human passivity in the Ars Moriendi literature. For Luther, sinners were utterly dead, and therefore were completely incapable of exercising any kind of agency to affect their spiritual resurrection. Luther introduced a new doctrine of suffering into early modern Christianity. And this new doctrine was central to his larger effort to reform the church of his day. As we have seen, he wanted Christians to embrace suffering as a divine gift that mortified their sinful nature, conformed them to Christ, and especially tested faith. He could also say that the embracing of suffering created empathy for other sufferers. Luther wished to strip Christians of the means they had traditionally employed to understand and cope with suffering, largely because he thought these means were basically pagan in origin. That is, he believed they relied on human reason to make sense of suffering and on human moral strength to appease or barter with God in the midst of it. In The Bondage of the Will, Luther says, look, if you're going to rely on human reason to make sense of suffering and try to reconcile it with a good God, you're going to wind up believing that God isn't there or that God is a cosmic misanthrope. That's where you wind up. The true Christian, the Christianus, was what Luther later called in his Genesis lectures a Cucianus, a Crostian. That is, a person who willingly took up the cross and suffered with Christ. Like Job, Crostians obediently submitted to divinely imposed suffering, even though it confounded their reason and threatened to shatter their faith. Crostians did not regard their suffering as a kind of penance, neither did they see it as a preparation for rapturous union with the divine essence, and they most certainly did not escape it through superstitious means. Crostians did not seek out suffering, but when it came, they accepted it and were content to stand before God on the basis of faith alone. Crostians trusted what the Word said about God, that God was good, rather than what reason and emotion concluded in the midst of suffering, that he was not. Luther understood that this approach to suffering left Christians in a potentially vulnerable situation that many would, and in fact did, find objectionable. This was what he calls elsewhere strong wine. He understood that faith alone could produce its own kind of anxiety. And this whole thesis about Luther's Reformation as a solution to the troubled consciences of later Middle Ages, this whole anxiety, Luther understood that his own solution could produce its own kind of anxiety. This is why he elsewhere referred to faith as a Kunst, as an art, as the kind of it's the kind of language you would use for an artisan who has to learn a craft gradually and become an expert. You're an apprentice and become a master. That's what faith is. It takes a lifetime to master it. In order to combat this anxiety, Luther made a number of recommendations to suffering Christians in both private letters and public sermons and pamphlets. He regularly urged people enduring personal afflictions to forsake solitude and to seek out the company of others who could console them with the word and with beer. Luther thought that the devil was the most lethal when left unchecked by the word and allowed to tempt and assail a Christian who was isolated from others. Luther especially urged participation in the Lord's Supper for those undergoing tribulation, because there you had visible signs of God's favor toward you. Luther also strongly recommended a reformed version of private confession to those burdened by trials and afflictions. Private confession. As we have seen, Luther emphasized again and again that the only way to escape despair and diabolical deception as one faced suffering was to be confident of the goodness of God pro me in the midst of adversity. The source of this confidence was faith in the divine promise of forgiveness offered to sinners as a free gift of grace. In other words, it was the power of the keys. The treasure of the church, as Luther referred to this power in the 95 Theses. For Luther, the single most effective means of applying the benefits of this treasure to the individual Christian was through private confession. Indeed, this was the primary reason he wished to retain a modified version of the traditional practice, to offer relief to consciences like his own that were plagued by Anfechtungen. You probably know the line where Luther comes back from the Wartburg. There have been all of these changes in Wittenberg. Karlstadt has wanted to abolish private confession. He says, Luther says, no way. I will allow no one to take private confession from me. If you haven't struggled deeply with the devil, then you don't understand how important this private confession is. He didn't want it to be mandatory at that point, but he would allow no one to take it from him. For Luther, the most difficult divine punishment to bear, as we've seen, was the consciousness of sin and the concomitant fear of death and judgment. Private confession provided both release from a guilty conscience and confidence of God's goodness in the face of other divine chastisements. It was essential, private confession was, to the strengthening of faith, which alone could perceive the goodness of the hidden God, hidden under its opposite. Owing in part to Luther's strong support for the rite, a reformed version of private confession would become a defining mark of Lutheran pastoral care in the early modern period. As in pre-Reformation Christianity, private confession became an important occasion for a ministry of verbal consolation in Lutheranism, although the theological basis and actual content of the rite underwent significant change. As an aside, I would say that the exclusion of private confession from most modern forms of Protestant Christianity, including most modern forms of Lutheranism, despite the fact that private confession is part of the original Protestant birthright, this is one of the most regrettable developments in the history of Protestant pastoral care. I think Luther was right about the importance of private confession in enabling the believer gradually over a lifetime to master the art of faith, especially in the midst of suffering. Luther's reformation of suffering assumes private confession, and he could not imagine his reformation of suffering working without private confession. Luther urged his new evangelical approach to suffering on his students and contemporaries because he thought it was true and because he thought it worked. Beyond simply functioning as a means of coping with adversity or a way of making sense of misfortune, Luther believed that this approach enabled believers to welcome the efforts of God to transform them into true Christians, that is, into those who were united with Christ by faith and thus animated by Christ's being and will. It's important not to miss the strong emphasis in Luther's work on the dynamic nature of the Christian life. The main reason he placed such a great emphasis on the necessity of suffering in the Christian life is that he saw it as the primary tool that God used to promote growth in faith and Christ-likeness. Listen to what he has to say along these lines in his sermons on 1 Peter 15:22. It is characteristic of a Christian life to improve constantly and to become purer. When we come to faith through the preaching of the gospel, we become frum, pious, and begin to be pure. But as long as we are still in the flesh, we never become completely pure. For this reason, God throws us right into the fire. That is, into suffering, disgrace, and misfortune. In this way, we are purged more and more until we die. No works can do this for us, for how can an external work cleanse the heart inwardly? But when faith is tested in this way, all alloy and everything false must disappear. Then, when Christ is revealed, splendid honor, praise, and glory will follow. Here, Luther is clearly interested in this worldly purgation taking place through suffering. And the primary effect of this purgation is the proving of faith as trust in the word and the growth in Christ-likeness that is to follow from it. Perhaps the greatest benefit, though, of such purified faith was that it was supposed to provide one with superior insight into the very will of God. Central to Luther's efforts to reform attitudes towards suffering was the conviction that he understood the purposes of divinely ordained tribulation far better than his adversaries did. Luther argued that his theology was superior to that of his adversaries because it provided a better account of why suffering occurred and how one was to contend with it, a more biblical account, he would have said. Early on in his second psalm lectures, the Operationes in Psalmos, 15:19-21, Luther claims that in his day, the wisdom of the cross has been, quote, hidden in a deep mystery. The reason for this mystery or confusion, he insists, is that most people are simply ignorant of God and God's ways when it comes to suffering. Luther asserts the following. They do not know, I say, what God does, what he wills, what he thinks, when he tempts us with tribulations. For they judge just as horses or mules, according to that which is seen and sensed. But what is seen is nothing other than humiliation, helplessness, death, and all things that were manifest to us in the suffering of Christ. If you only look upon these things and do not discern the will of God in them and bear this will and praise it, you will necessarily take offense at this cross and seek refuge in yourself, or you will soon become an idolater and attribute to a creature the glory due to God alone. They do not know. But Luther believed he did. In many ways, Luther saw himself as a prophet. This is something that's become very clear to me, teaching the bondage of the will again. A prophet who was divinely prepared and illumined to discern and declare the divine will to God's wayward people. Suffering had been the primary means through which God had purged, cleansed, and expanded his own soul, thus making it a suitable conduit through which the divine message of grace and its implications for suffering could flow from God to Luther and from Luther to others. This claim of superior insight into the divine will and its purposes regarding suffering directly informed the reformation of Christianity that Luther proposed to his contemporaries and helps to account for why the reformation of suffering was so central to it. Thank you.
Want to thank Dr. Rittgers for this excellent presentation that really sets in context what Luther does as a pastor, as one who is working theologically to bring consolation under the cross. And of course, as you've kind of alluded to, you've laid this out for us, but Luther so often attaches the Holy Cross to the preaching of the gospel, so that cross and suffering then are not foreign territory for the Christian and for the confessor. We do have a few minutes before we end up for questions and answers. So if you have some questions for Dr. Rittgers, Dr. McKenzie.
Thank you for a very interesting and stimulating presentation. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome.
With respect to suffering in the 16th century, Luther's time, he really didn't have any choice. Whether he was a medieval Catholic or Reformed Protestant or Martin Luther, he and everybody else was going to suffer. It was a routine part of life. And as far as I can tell, even the medical procedures of those days were a form of suffering rather than...
They typically inflicted more suffering, that's true.
Doesn't that make it really difficult to move from what Luther had to say about embracing suffering to our own times, in which we really, to a great extent, organize our lives around avoiding suffering, and indeed devote ourselves to one form of pleasure or another, recognizing that bad things still happen. But if suffering comes along, the first thing I do is, look for an aspirin. So in terms of the application...
But that will eat out your stomach lying,
there
right?
There you go. There you go.
So you can't escape it.
You can't escape it. But is it the problem that I'm trying to think about here?
Sure. It's a problem of trying to lift Luther out of the 16th century.
Yeah.
And bring him into the 21st century, what he has to say about suffering. And right, in terms of the presence, the palpable presence of suffering, Luther's age was much different than our own. Although the people who actually lived past, say, 5 or 6 years old were pretty hardy people in the early modern period.
Sure.
So it's not that they were constantly suffering, but they were much more vulnerable. At least they knew they were much more vulnerable than we will admit. I guess, it's difficult maybe to make that transition, but that's the whole point. That's why Luther, I think, is so valuable. This message of don't flee it, That's the message of Luther, I think, to this desire to avoid. That's why I was driving at this. It's not all about, well, a new gospel that releases you from a guilty conscience, and isn't that wonderful consolation? Yes, but that's only part of it. It's taking up this cross, and you can't take up this cross until you have this. So maybe Luther's sort of prescription for our age is a deeper experience of divine consolation so that you can embrace this. You don't have to run from it. Or maybe even beyond that, that suffering is, I mean, this is in some ways, this is the most scandalous thing that Luther says, and it's something nearly every pre-modern theologian says. God bears some sort of causal relationship to suffering.
Yeah.
That in and of itself, I think, is the scandal.
People don't want to hear that.
But I guess, I think you're right. I mean, I'm trained as a historian. I understand the difficulties of making that journey to the past and bring it to the present. But I think what I was presenting today is precisely what many folks need to hear, that trying to flee suffering is, in a sense, you're avoiding one of God's primary means of conforming you into the image of his Son. And I guess the other thing I would say is, I think we've just invented new forms of suffering in the modern period. It's certain kinds of suffering maybe are not with us the way they used to be, but we've invented all kinds of new forms of suffering that Luther probably knew nothing of. It's just the other night, I'm one doctor tells me I have a broken heel right now, another says it's just badly bruised through soccer. So there's a Luther didn't know soccer. Unfortunate man.
Any other questions? Yes.
Maybe to follow up on that, and again, this is trying to bring something into the contemporary context.
Sure, sure.
What would Luther's view be based on your research about things like fasting?
Like what?
Like fasting or self-imposed disciplines, especially since you pointed out the importance of this distinction between divine imposed.
Yeah.
Punishments or suffering versus just sort of man-made ones. I mean, how would you see kind of a person who, because I mean, my thought was, well, okay, if we don't suffer enough in this age, would it be helpful to discipline ourselves to begin to appreciate that, or would Luther kind of say, well, no, that's going down the wrong direction again because that's just man.
You know, in the Freedom of the Christian, Luther has a lot to say about bodily mortification. You know, he makes this distinction. He sets out the paradox, and then he says, we're going to deal with the inner person and then the outer person. And so as he deals with the outer person, the disciplining of the flesh so that you can better serve the neighbor is fine with him. It's the motivation for doing it. You're not supposed to see fasting as a means of penance for sin anymore, but that you needed to discipline the flesh, especially early on. He's fine with that, I think. It's the motivation behind it. I mean, it depends how severe the fasting is. And I think the crucial thing, and Luther's not the first one to say this either, there's something false about self-imposed discipline because the self is still at the center. You can find this in Henry Suzo, one of the most famous late medieval German mystics. He beats himself to a pulp, and then he realizes that, well, this really wasn't what God wanted. Because you're still at the center of your own spiritual life. You're developing, you're in control of your own spiritual life, even if you're fasting in very harsh ways. And the point is to decenter the self. And Luther is very much aware of that critique.
Dr. Just, in the book of Acts, sometimes we think of the suffering of the apostles as being the ongoing sufferings of Christ, even though Christ's sufferings satisfied, we see Christ's sufferings in the sufferings of the apostles.
Yeah. That's a great question.
And as you said about the Lord's Supper, that it's a place where we see divine favor, was that also pointed to as a place where we can participate in Christ's suffering?
You know, this language of the participation in Christ's suffering is tricky language for Luther and for early modern Lutherans. In my research, what I have found is a very strong emphasis on Christ participating in the Christian's suffering. Because they believe they have scriptural warrant for this. When Christ confronts Saul, why are you persecuting me? So Christ is present in Christian suffering. And you can find this in Lutheran sermons on the Passion, for example. That's a very strong emphasis. but that it would go the other way. I think of this as an Einbahnstrasse, as a one-way street, that Christ is present in the Christian's suffering, but that Christians would participate in sort of in a sort of late medieval passion piety kind of way of filling out. I mean, that language is tricky, right? Of filling out the remaining suffering for Christ. That's something that was, I think, problematic because it was seen as being salvific. And Christ's work is completed. It's finished. There's nothing more that Christ has to do. So in what sense would you be filling out Christ's suffering? Christ participates in your suffering. He's present. And Luther's Christology allows for the descent of the Logos into human flesh in a really deep way, a really interesting way. But that it would go the other way, as you find in a lot of medieval mystics, I mean, wanting to, you know, there's no Lutheran stigmatics, right? I mean, who take on the visible wounds of Christ, participate in that way. And I don't see that emphasis in Luther's Eucharistic theology. Someone can correct me if they'd like to.
Dr.
Skier?
Your presentation of Luther seems at direct odds with American popular Protestantism, which really seems to me has more place for prosperity and health than it does for suffering. And that when it seems to be confront suffering, it looks upon an additional, it's almost a form of Catholicism, that it's a penalty for sin which the individual has committed. I know that when Norman Vincent Peale, that belonged more to my age than yours, is that whenever somebody got sick in the congregation, he ran from it. Mm-hmm. Now, does this come from Calvin? Or
it must.
The idea that this seems to be almost a form of, it certainly is what you presented, it certainly is not Lutheran. Suffering.
Does fleeing from suffering? Is that the question? Does fleeing from suffering, the prosperity gospel kind of thing?
Yeah, simply ignoring that suffering takes place.
Yeah. No, that doesn't come from Calvin. I mean, just read his sermons on the book of Job. A lot of what I have said, not everything I've said today, Calvin would have agreed with. I think it's a later development, the sort of prosperity gospel. Now, if you're referring to Max Weber's take on Calvin, that somehow, you know, if you become prosperous, this is a sign that you're among the elect. Maybe so. I mean, no one believes in Weber, but everyone believes in Weber, right? I mean, we keep arguing about him as if there's something to what he has to say, even though it's been refuted time and again. But I wouldn't locate the origins of that in Calvin himself. I think there are all kinds of more contemporary cultural developments that account for this emphasis on prosperity gospel. But I think you're absolutely right. Luther would win no popularity contests with the kinds of things that I had to say. May I ask you all a question? What about private confession? Are you in your courses here, those of you who are students here, being trained how to hear confession? Maybe that's too close to home for me to ask that. This is something that's come out of my research. I mean, it's in a sense what I'm doing in this talk is I'm putting these two books together, right? And one of the things that's become very clear to me is how central the declaration of private absolution was for Luther's pastoral care. This is right at the heart of sound biblical pastoral care for Luther. And there are huge battles about what form it should take and whether it belongs in Protestantism at all, but Luther was utterly convinced of this. And I know some folks who are maybe over 60-ish, who maybe have grown up with this, but I don't know many younger Lutherans who have had this experience.
I think it's actually switched in our circles. Yeah.
It's the young. Yeah. I think it started maybe 20 years ago, where that became much more of an important pastoral care item than just a therapeutic model.
That's precisely the reason it's so important, I think.
So you have a lot more pastors actually as part of dealing with marital problems and the like, using confession and absolution in their pastoral care of those things.
One of your predecessors at Valparaiso was Kenneth Corby, and probably more than any other theologian of the last generation, he really recovered individual confession and absolution as a topic of mm-hmm. pastoral theology, and his language was, again, it was the seat and the center of evangelical pastoral care. Yeah. And Corby has been influential in, I think, a number of us.
Great.
The seminary.
So I'm preaching to the choir.
That was a marvelous encouragement.
Unfortunately, we are at the end of the hour, but we want to thank Dr. Excellent presentation.
Thank you.
And you know the books now, so you kind of had your cups primed for further study and reading.